Accession number 20600, reel 2.
Ray Russell, reel 2. And landing at Algiers, please.
Yes, I remember that quite clearly because it was a beautiful day and you could see all the white buildings on the hillside behind Algiers. We landed on in the docks and disembarked in the docks. And then we formed up and we were told to put on our greatcoats. This was in Algiers at a time of the year when, although it was still March, it was still quite hot. We then put on our full packs and marched from Algiers to a transit camp at Hassin Dey, which I think was probably about 4 or 5 miles away. Unfortunately, of course, although I had been quite keen on marching and had always kept up the RAF traditional marching, most of my colleagues from the outstations hadn't been subject to that at all since their initial training, so they suffered rather from the walk. And I always remember with embarrassment the comments made by the army personnel as they marched past us. Why we were told to wear overcoats, our greatcoats, I would never know, because totally unnecessary in that heat, which didn't make our life any better, particularly in view of the fact, of course, the army were just marching past us at a brisk pace in their battle dress.
So you're in transit at Hassin Dey?
Yes. That was a transit camp, say, just a few miles outside Algiers. We were in tents. One or two interesting things happened there. One night, there was an air raid in progress over Algiers, and I was on the beach, which was near the tented camp, watching the display of fireworks over Algiers. And suddenly there was an almighty crash immediately behind me, just a few yards away, and a blast of hot air. And I felt I'd been hit by a bomb or something, but I hadn't actually been thrown flat, but I had been sort of thrown off balance. Only to realise that I was standing quite close to an American anti-aircraft battery, which had about 4 large calibre guns which were fired remotely and simultaneously. So I'd actually heard 4 anti-aircraft guns going off simultaneously just a few feet away. Later on, I don't know how long, probably about half an hour later, an enemy aircraft actually landed on the beach about a quarter of a mile away. It had been shot down and managed just to make the edge of the beach. And I think the crew were all safe and they were arrested by the army and marched off.
This was an enemy fighter?
Bomber.
Did you know what you were destined for?
Oh, well, I knew we had to set up the Meekening site in North Africa. As I said, I did have some pre-knowledge of this because I had been involved in the preparing the equipment for it. And obviously all the people who were on the rest of the personnel knew they were all Meekening people anyway, so they knew what they were going to do. After a few days there, the CEO asked me to go down to Oran, which was then curiously called New Oran, which is another port further east in Algeria, and to supervise the unloading of some of our equipment. Of course, our equipment came by different ships, cargo ships, that had been unloaded at Oran. I was down there, I flew down there in a Dakota. Curious enough, the German aircrew that had been shot down were also in the aircraft being taken somewhere else under escort. I think the only other amusing incident in that case was there was a naval petty officer on the getting on the Dakota, DC-3. He was absolutely terrified of flying, and I tried to comfort him and give him reassuring messages and so on, but he was really terrified. When we got to the other end and we landed safely at Oran, he invited me to go and visit him on his ship. It was a submarine. No way. So that's when Horses for Courses comes into mind. Anyways, I was attached to the Navy for a few days. I don't know how many days. I was sleeping in a hammock on a shore station. It was quite interesting. Had a look around Oran. And then I think with the CO and probably the senior flight sergeant, we supervised the assembling of the convoy vehicles, which were then driven back from Oran to Hasinde. And I actually drove a vehicle for the first time in the RAF. The CO asked me if I could drive. Fortunately, I could, so he asked me to drive him back in, I think it was a Jeep, which was a new experience for me, having never driven anything like that before in my life. And we got back to Hasinde. And then within a day or two, we went straight off to a place called Borj Manile, about 50 or 60 miles east of Algiers.
How do you spell that?
B-O-R-J M-E-N E-I-A-L, I think, an Arab name. Well, we requisitioned a schoolhouse. That was a sort of HQ set up there. The vehicles were in the local football ground. And then within 1 or 2 days, some of us were sent to the receiver site, which was about 6 miles away, at a site called Cap Jinet, D-J-I-N-E-T. Jinet is actually the Arab word for genie or devil, so devilscape. There we had the receiver site, which was a large articulated vehicle, a comma prime mover, with what was called the Queen Mary on the back, which was a long low loader truck, which was used for transporting aircraft fuselages and aircraft parts, with a cabin built onto it, and we had a complete receiving site in there. We set up the aerials, and at the transmitter site, which was back in Borj Manile, they set up their equipment there, the transmitter equipment, and all the transmitting aerials. We didn't have any form of coaxial cable landline there to join the two sites, so that was a VHF link, VHF radio link, so that our signals, which were received, were sent down by a VHF radio to the transmitter site, and then converted back, and we retransmitted from there. We were covering, I think, mostly the Eastern Mediterranean area then, and obviously the Algiers area. Although we didn't know it at the time, we were apparently under American control then, because it was the First Army area. So it was quite an interesting time. Living in tents and occasional days. We're only about 3 miles from the coast. I used to drive down there. I learnt to swim there because we'd splashed about in the water several occasions without swimming. Then one day we found, I suppose, a little cliff about 10 feet high. Everyone jumped in the water and so did I. Then I remember I couldn't swim. So I learnt quite rapidly.
Had you had any problems setting up the two sites?
No, not really. Everything was quite smooth. We all knew exactly what to do. And yes, there were difficulties in actually raising the large 60-foot masts. But, I mean, that was to be expected. We knew how to overcome the problems and how to do it. So
And all the equipment had arrived safely.
Everything in working order.
How long did it take to get it all set up?
Oh, I wouldn't think it'd be more than about a week, if that. Because everything had been pre-tested and pre-set up in the UK, and it was shipped over in the vehicles, and so apart from any damage which might occur in transit, it was all ready to operate.
And what role did you have in the setting up?
Well, as a radio mechanic, I mean, I was there to make sure the equipment was working and to assist in erecting the aerials, testing the equipment, and so on.
What rank did you have at this time?
Corporal.
And once it was underway, what did you have to do personally?
Basically just the maintenance equipment, and day-to-day work, and that was it. Which wasn't very strenuous, as you can imagine, because the equipment was basically fairly reliable, but would occasionally have to do realignment jobs or make small adjustments to things.
Did it work just as well under North African conditions as it would have done in England?
Yes. But it'd be quite successful.
Any incidents that happened to you here?
Not particularly, no. We were there for only a fairly short time. They were left in December. We closed down in December of that year, in 43. And were intended to go to Corsica to set up over there. Because the Allies had advanced into Italy, and North Africa was now clear of the Germans. We packed up everything and set off for Bizerta in Tunisia to be shipped across to Corsica.
With the same equipment?
Same equipment, the only thing that I remember outstanding about that was the fact that one of the lorries, a 3-ton Bedford, had 40 brakes on it. And for some reason, which I've never quite understood, the RAF transport drivers by trade could refuse to drive a 40 lorry, or a dangerous. This I couldn't understand in wartime. Anyway, I was asked if I would volunteer to drive this. Again, being the only other known driver. I, of course, naturally said yes. And found that, yes, the brakes were 40, but I could drive it. But in view of the fact that the brakes were 40, it was felt advisable that I shouldn't try and keep up with the convoy, but I should just carry on at my own speed and catch up with the convoy whenever they stopped, which I did, so I drove carefully, making sure that I used the gears as much as possible and as little of the brakes as possible. And I forget how many days this took. I think it was 5 or 6 days. But it certainly occurred over the Christmas period, and we did actually stop for Christmas lunch at a place which had been previously called Messerschmitt Alley. And we had a lunch, Christmas lunch out in the open. How the cooks produced everything, I don't know, but they did. They were all sitting at a table having a Christmas lunch. After that, we went on to Bizerta, and that was when the fun really started with this lorry. By then, the brakes were getting steadily worse, and I was tending to go off ahead of the convoy then, because I was having to go slower still. And so I'd be going off ahead of the convoy, accompanied by one, I think, a sergeant in a small truck. And then the convoy would come and pass me. I would then try and catch up with them at the next stopping point. It was quite fun. I had another corporal with me in the cab. And we were going through the Atlas Mountains, which was quite fun, as you can imagine. And having gone through several days of travelling through the mountains, the last day, we came to one particular steep part. I put my foot on the brakes, and they just weren't there at all. Fortunately, I had changed down to about the first gear, so it was still manageable, but it was getting faster. And the corporal with me was quite prepared to abandon ship. So I was trying to steer the thing with this hand and grabbing hold of him and telling him, for God's sake, don't jump out. And he eventually decided to stay with me. So I eventually got it down around the corners and everything else and onto the plains. And we pulled up at Bizerta. And I got out of the lorry and my legs wouldn't stand the weight. I just collapsed on the floor. Quite extraordinary. I recovered very rapidly, but that was the first time I realised what stress can do to you. Quite exciting.
Did your unit have a number?
Yes, it was number 21 MSU.
FSU?
MSU.
What does MSU stand for?
Probably Meekin's signals unit. Meekin's signals unit, probably.
So you're now at Bizerta Docks?
That's right. We then boarded a tank landing craft. And this provided a few problems. They were mostly American, although it was a British Royal Naval craft. It was mostly American troops on it, with American vehicles, and we had to load our vehicles on as well. These long Queen Marys have very low ground clearance. Now, on the landing craft, you go up a ramp across a level and down a ramp into it. This meant, of course, that the Queen Marys wouldn't clear the ramp, so they had to be lifted at the back by a crane, driven in, and then put down again. Which was fine going in. When we got across to Corsica, I think 2 days later, we had the same problem in reverse. And by then, of course, the thing was facing the wrong way. The journey over there was quite interesting. It was one of the roughest storms they'd had in the Atlantic for so many years. And at one point during the voyage, the CO called me out. Oh, no, not the CO, sorry, the station warrant officer called me out to tell me that one of our vehicles had broken loose in the hold. And they were to take a party of men down to secure it. But we've got hundreds of these vehicles down there, all held in position with chains. There was one of our transmitter units lurching backwards and forwards. And there we were in the dark with torches, trying to do something about it. Now, of course, every time we got near it, it then decided to come the other way, so we had to rush out of the way. And having spent about 15 minutes trying to avoid being crushed to death, we had to go back and ask for assistance from the Navy. They came down within about 10 minutes and secured it, so they were quite accustomed to that little problem.
Where did you go to in Corsica?
Ajaccio, which was the main town in Corsica. We set up temporary camp there in Ajaccio airfield. Not operational at that time, we just assembled all the vehicles and had a tented camp while we received further information about what we had to do. A party went up to North Corsica with intention of setting up the transmitter site, and I stayed behind on that one. The CO went up there and they had a lot of problems getting the vehicles up there, because these, particularly these long 60-foot vehicles, negotiating these mountain passes with very sharp bends were a problem. Now, there were two occasions where there were low bridges which weren't quite as wide. The parapets weren't quite as wide as the vehicles. Well, fortunately, the Queen Marys had curved fronts. So leave it to your imagination. They with the lorry going forward and being pushed from the back, I'm afraid the parapets were pushed off, so we just left with a flat bridge, which was quite wide enough to accommodate the vehicle. However, having gone through his trials, getting the vehicles up to North North Corsica. We're then told that we weren't needed after all. The Allied advance in Italy was such that weakening wasn't required, but we were required back in UK. Rumour had it to go on the second front. So we then had to do everything in reverse, bring all these vehicles back from the north down to the south. One exciting incident on that, although I wasn't present, was that the one of the large vehicles with a transmitter in it, a Crosley, which I'm sure was a vehicle left over from the First World War, also had brake problems. Unfortunately, he was immediately behind the CO in a small comma 1500 weight. And as they were coming down the mountain pass, the mountain road, the brakes failed. He came straight down, hit the CO in the back, shot him straight over the edge of the cliff. Sheer drop of several hundred feet. The heavy lorry managed to get round the corner and stopped himself by ramming the side of the mountain. The CO fortunately landed on a large tree about 30 feet below. So he, and even the vehicle, was quite in good condition. So it was hauled back and he returned back to Ajaccio.
What was his name?
Flight Lieutenant Freeman. I think his name was Freeman.
And then?
The driver was court-martialed, but I think he was let off because he couldn't do much about the brake failing. Once it had proved it was the brake failed and not his dislike of the CO. So then we reassembled and reversed the process. We went back on another tank landing craft to... we didn't. We went back in a normal ship back to Algiers this time, to a different transit camp. Then after about a week, we came back to UK. We left all the vehicles in Corsica and they were handled by somebody else who shipped them back to the UK. They followed, I think, about a month later.
Where did you go to in England, to Radlett?
I came back to Radlett, to HQ. The rest of the personnel were dispersed to various sites. Some of them were sent over to Europe. Yes, by then, the Second Front hadn't started, but we were assembling all the equipment for it. So I stayed in Radlett. But some of the people on the same unit by then had, in fact, went over to Belgium.
What job did you now have at Radlett?
Same job, except I was now a sergeant.
Had things changed at all there?
Well, obviously, more up-to-date equipment had come in, particularly from America. And we were operating a few more new systems. I think the new challenge then became... I'm going too far ahead now. We're getting equipment ready for the Second Front. And I do remember the June the 6th, 1944, when we were going to breakfast in the sergeant's mess and saw the aircraft, the Dakotas, going over with all the gliders behind them. Quite impressive. Even the Radlett, all going across from there. Then we had the news of the Second Front starting that day. After that, of course, the next threat came not from enemy signals over this country to an extent, but from the V1, the doodlebug, which didn't really directly concern us, except that in some of the initial wave of V1s coming over, they did have the occasional transmitter in them so that they could determine where they were landing. They could track them, in other words. We did, I think, I'm not sure whether we meekened or jammed them, but one way or other we tried to disrupt that. But I think it was only about 1 in 6 or 1 in 10 of the bombs actually had this transmitter in it. And I don't think it gave the Germans much information, because as far as I remember, they discontinued that practice. relied on intelligence reports or aerial observation.
Any V1 strikes near Radler?
There was one about 3/4 mile away. I'd been into Boreham Wood the previous evening to a cinema there and was walking back towards Radlett and I heard this thing go over. I heard the engine cut out and the bang. When I got back to near HQ, I could see the crater in the field about 3/4 mile away. That was the only instance.
So it didn't do any damage? Any V2s?
Yes, that was interesting. It was a beautiful summer's day. I think it was September, actually, and it was a very quiet day, and suddenly we heard this tremendous explosion in the distance, and we didn't know what it was, but one of our officers came in and then told us that the first of the V2s had landed, but it was completely to be kept quiet because we didn't want anyone to know, we didn't want the Germans to know where it had landed. Or if it had been successful in. Then I think next day or a couple of days later there was another one we could hear, and that was at Enfield or North London somewhere, maybe Edmonton. And I think after that the first one was given as a gas explosion in Chiswick. I don't know what the excuse was for the second one, whether it was a gas explosion or whether by then we were admitting they were landing. But that was the next problem, because these were initially had a form of radio control on them. I went down to Farnborough to the Royal Aircraft Establishment where they were working on the radio controls from these V2s. They had a complete one there which I think had been sent from Sweden, and also some damaged units from V2s which had landed in this country. The civilian scientists there had worked out how the things were operating. I had circuit diagrams. I still have one. And we're trying to devise countermeasures. The countermeasures were going to be extremely difficult because the V2 control operated on two signals only. It had a receiver which was fairly insensitive, would only react to signals, fairly strong signals, from short distance, in other words from its launch site. And the two signals that were sent to it were one to cut the engine and the others to determine the trajectory. And these lasted just about a second or so each. So we'd have to know, back in UK, the frequency in which the signal was going to be sent out, which could have been one of many. We had to know the frequency of the first signal, the audio signal, and the frequency of the second audio signal, all within a matter of seconds, and then try and jam it from UK, hundreds or so miles away, which was actually subsequently decided to be almost impossible. But we had been setting up equipment in the UK, particularly the Americans had been setting up something called Tuba on the East Coast, which was an extremely powerful transmitter, which was intended to blot out the entire wave band they were using. But again, of course, you couldn't operate it continuously, for obvious reasons. Of course, the equipment itself wouldn't operate it continuously. So then they were faced with the problem of trying to operate it when they thought the V2s were going to be launched. In the event the Germans didn't use the radio control for long, they went over to another system, a sort of gyroscope or something, which did the same job without radio control. So radio countermeasures weren't required.
Why had you been sent to Farnborough?
Good point. I suppose we needed to know at Radlett as much as possible about what was going on and to assist them if necessary with radio countermeasures. So any technical information coming out of Farnborough could be fed back to us. And I suppose in our workshop we could produce a prototypes or something to assist the radio countermeasures. I also went down from there to TREs at Malvern for a few days on the same job with another bunch of civilian scientists. I think it was when I was there that it was decided that very little could be done about it. Of course, we had earmarked, or it had been arranged for various locations around the country to be